Welcome to the Grimshaw Podcast. Today we present our fourth series, The Intelligent City, with your host, Tim Williams.
Hello, I'm Tim Williams. I'm the host of the Grimshaw Cities podcast series, and I'm delighted to say today that I have with me Dr. Sarah Barnes, who's going to talk about all things smart cities, AI and cities, platform urbanism. We shall talk about all of that, but it sounds very up to speed with what's going on out there, so I'm very delighted to have her here. And in a departure from our normal practice, we're going to ask Andy Watts, who's head of design technology at Grimshaw, to join us towards the end of the conversation with his reflections on what you've just heard, a revolutionary development in the podcast. So you're very welcome, both of you. So, Sarah, good to see you again. So you've been busy, I think. You've published quite a lot recently, a book on platform urbanism, what the hell is that? And then a chapter in a book on artificial intelligence and the city, which I think is really interesting as well. So what is platform urbanism anyway?
Thanks, Tim. It's good to be talking to you about these topics. We have a bit of a history of conversations about urban technology, don't we?
We do.
So platform urbanism, yeah, this is a term that I started to work with actually in 2013 when I started to consider the ways that digital platforms were quite kind of unique in the way that they established different data harvesting and data accumulation practices in ways that weren't really obvious to people who use them. So I actually came from a background in digital media. I worked for quite a while at the ABC in their R&D or innovation labs area. And, you know, this was the whole time of like the emergence of social media, emergence of Facebook. We were thinking a lot about the ABC, about what was the role of the ABC in the social media landscape.
And the ABC being the Australian Broadcasting Company, not the American version.
Thank you, Tim. That's right. We are in an Australian context here. Yes, we sort of think of the ABC as sort of omnipotent here in Australia, but it's in fact not, is it? Yes. But, you know, we were really thinking about what is the role of a public broadcaster, a public space, a digital public space in this emerging landscape. And because I had a background in city policy and sustainability policy myself, I started to think, well, what will it mean to have these kind of platform ecosystems like say a Facebook at that time, you know, but ultimately a Google or an Amazon starting to operate in the everyday spaces of the city. And I thought, well, that's going to actually really change the way that cities operate. It's going to change the requirements of city governments and how they might regulate technology. It's also going to change the way we as individuals might relate to each other, whether that's, you know, through our social feeds or something more ambient, as it's turned out. So yeah, this was the idea that kind of came to me. It was a bit of one of these sort of aha moments, I have to say, in 2013. And I've really been working on the sort of topic ever since. I think we've often, you know, as you and I know, Tim, we've been encouraged to think through the lens of smart cities when we think about this kind of stuff. But it's not a term that I've loved that much.
Let's explore that, because in one sense, smart cities was the revolution that never happened. In that it felt like a great idea. The coming together, as and you and I have talked about this, of the operations of a city government, for example, every day, modernized effectively at one level through technology, and then at another level, and this is like 15 years ago thinking, 10 years ago thinking, and then at another level, it would enable stronger civic input, you know, civic engagement in testing policies, in responding to services, improving services, just like the online universe has helped private sector companies get much closer to their clients. There was that kind of thinking. But it was also wrapped up in this kind of, well, it's still a government. It's still smart government, you know. So what's the link with democracy? What's the link with, and how do you link with these technological, you know, sort of explosion stuff and the capacity of that with these institutions, right? And I began to see over a period of time that although this seemed like a great idea and an obvious thing, you saw smart city initiatives within certain departments in government or certain councils across the world, but nothing quite as systemic as I was expecting. It, in my terms, it remained a bit hobbyist. It was kind of, you know, and I think also I underestimated the difficulty of changing existing business models and the way that people operate. Just because there's some new technology over here, they don't automatically think, ah, business process reengineering, I'll do it tomorrow. Right, so that it was a bit less dramatic than I thought it was. And then the last bit of the equation, it seems to me, is that then there was this discussion about whether we want to survey people quite as much as we could do with sensors everywhere, you know, picking up human movements, you know, views, all that stuff. And there began to be a discussion about whether it was slightly sinister to the smart city wasn't everything we thought it was. What do you think about what happened to smart cities and where did it end up?
Well, I certainly think, you know, it's not a chapter that's concluded by any sense. But I think ultimately smart cities we would now look at as being very much a public sector led innovation program. Early experiments, sure, came out of like IBM and Cisco and the like, but ultimately they were targeted at a sort of public sector landscape. And so many smart city initiatives are kind of reflect that, you know, they're public-private partnerships, but they center around the capacity of that, city authority to be able to manage multiple integrated data sets to achieve, a certain set of smart city outcomes. And of course, in more recent years, that's been attached to, you know, things like SDGs and sustainability outcomes. So the smart city, you know, it certainly does continue in that vein, but what I see has been happening in the meantime is that we have these, for example, clever apps that allow us to, hail a cab and go from one place to another quite easily. And it's not really anything that sits within any smart city policy of a government necessarily. It's quite a different set of strategies. And over time, that capacity to engage consumers, engage businesses through those kind of app ecosystems, if you like, has actually proved quite transformative.
That's very interesting, actually, because that we sometimes don't put those two things together. I thought it was really good. But also what comes out of that for me is it, you know, there was always a discussion at the beginning of the online world, you know, about the democratic possibilities, the kind of decentralization, the fact that you could be your own music producer, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And what you're talking to there has been a phase of that where small companies, entrepreneurs, and you're an entrepreneur as well, have just come up with ideas and developed apps, and it's on an app store somewhere and people use it. And so there's been quite a lot of individual empowering, I guess. There is an individual empowerment stuff going on with this, where I can navigate a city I've never been to before by using these various tools, right? So that's very interesting, very in all sorts of ways positive, and certainly quite formative of our experience of the city. Now, you know, a city I've never been to, I navigate very sort of well and safely, like I could never do before. Although I'm still very 19th century myself, and I still like using books, you know, I don't want to sound retrograde. But then there's this other side where you begin to think, you know, at the same time, you've got these giants like, you know, Facebook, Google, you mentioned them, becoming like very, very dominant in our lives and beginning to have a almost like a civic impact, you know, whether or not we want it to, really. They're so big. They're powerful. So you've got smart cities, you've got these apps things, that, and then you've got these big tech based companies going on. It's a completely different scenario to 20 years ago, profoundly, and it's affected the way the cities and people operate in cities.
And that's, you know, Tim, you've kind of captured my kind of book's main thesis on platform urbanism, that ultimately it did emerge out of these handy, sharing social network type sensibilities that were really about that capacity to curate and coordinate individuals, people who are, you know, working towards their, you know, their own intelligences, their own interests. It's not as though it's this sort of top-down surveillance society type approach that we think of with the worst sides of smart cities. But in fact, so we're very self-motivated to work with, you know, many of the platforms that help us to get around the city today. But ultimately, what's happened is that process of engaging people through the premises of networking and self-empowerment has actually created these huge, what I like to call kind of platform architectures that are way more powerful than, many of the individual authorities or governing entities that operate in cities.
It's worth having a sort of private public sector moment about this, because I was involved improbably, for people who know me even, and Sarah knows me, but I have had a bit of an involvement. You know, despite knowing nothing, as Andy Watts will tell me as we proceed to him at some point, that I know nothing really about technology at all. But I was very interested in the business process reengineering potential of technology. I was interested in the kind of democratic potential of technology. And I was interested in just how it's a game changer, which, you know, and it has been all those things, and it is profoundly impactful. But I don't think our governance has caught up with all this kind of stuff. And what I was going to say about the public-private moment was that I did some work recently for the New South Wales government on thinking about smart cities, smart places. And one of the things we were heavily involved with lots of local councils, and lots of local, you know, there have been great councils internationally who've led on this kind of agenda. But they were often saying in these discussions that they were being sort of hunted down by entrepreneurial private sector, you know, offers of services. And they actually didn't necessarily have the capacity to work out which ones they wanted to work with, that they was beyond their pay grade. You know, and there was like a desire for some guidance and advice about, you know, how you might do this. And it is a kind of, it's not quite Wild West, you know, but it had been quite difficult for people who are, you know, of a smaller scale to work out when these big guys come at you saying, we can give you a platform to do everything you want. They don't know exactly how to deal with that as a proposition, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a huge issue. It's kind of capacity building at local government level is a major challenge, because, you know, questions around data use, data ownership, what do you get when you get a platform, you know, subscription-based model can appear super appealing and low cost, you know, in the first year or so. But if you might do the sums over a 10-year period, for example, what are the costs there? What are you losing in terms of your own internal data capabilities? And I think this is only going to accelerate with the age of AI, because you see more local government agencies having less intelligence than many of the operators that are coming to them. By intelligence, I don't mean human intelligence, of course, but I mean data processing intelligence. So the question is, you know, who is the most appropriate kind of custodian for a lot of the integrated data that is being generated through smart and connected services? Like, it perhaps, you know, as we've heard and as we know from recent security and privacy conversations, you know, you need to have huge amounts of security capabilities in place. So local government may not in fact be the right kind of custodian of our urban data. We need to have a conversation, I think.
If we look at a bit at the area that we're in, New South Wales, where New South Wales government, the previous one, had a pretty good story about what the work it was doing around the link between, I think, consumer protection and data and some modernization of services through technology. I mean, have we got a good story to tell in New South Wales better than some other places? What do you think?
Look, I've not been intimately involved myself, but my perception is that, yes, we do have a good story to tell in New South Wales. I think there's been a strong adaptation of what's known in the policy wonk circles here, the sort of government as a platform kind of model, which does recognize the importance of these kind of platform ecosystems at play and sets out a clear role for government in that place. So the Digital Transformation Office, for example, you know, Ian Oppenheimer's work, I think, has been really you know, forward leading, front leading in terms of the Australian state government landscape. Absolutely. I think we've started to see some of the services benefits that's come from that.
Before we go on to talk about, I want to talk a bit about the private sector. I also want to talk a bit about the ambient commons, which are, you know, given that Grimshaw of Interest does things like street furniture, beautiful street furniture, like on George Street, with, you know, the integration of that world with like sensors, and we should talk a bit about that, right? I was going to say that part of the challenge for all of us in the world of that has exploded since the 90s around data and online technologies is the difference between, I remember going to a wonderful conference in Barcelona. I rarely get to travel in my work, not really. You know, I get to go to like Parramatta, which is lovely, but it's only 20 kilometers away. You know, but I got to go to Barcelona for the World Mobile Congress or something. I gave a talk, but disastrous talk. I just want to tell you, disastrous because the technology didn't work, right? Okay, but the story, the thing that was fascinating for me is there were 70,000 people there. All purporting to be obsessed with the online world, all talking to each other face to face. So they had to be in Barcelona, right? But I just think what came out of that was a tremendous presentation by a bloke who said there's a difference between data, information, knowledge, and wisdom. That's the hierarchy. I thought, wow, that's brilliant. And actually, public sector, private sector, they've all been deluged by data, and it doesn't automatically lead to wisdom. And I do think it's still the kind of greatest challenge. We all love new things and technology, but it's generating so much like stuff that actually handling it all is a very, and learning from it all strikes me as quite a difficult thing to do. Let's go to the ambient commons, right? So you're associated. I think it's great to be associated with concepts in your professional career. And I think platform urbanism, I can't remember if you invented it, but you've definitely made it your own, right? So Sarah says you did invent it, which is great. Whenever I say I invent things, I get accused of megalomania, right? But I think you did, right? But ambient commons, what's the ambient commons?
So I didn't invent the term ambient commons.
No.
Platform urbanism, yes, I was the first to use it. It was very difficult for me to publish under it in terms of traditional academic journal because I just didn't know, like, what's this all about? So it took me about 3 years to get...
It's difficult to peer review innovation.
It's very difficult, let me tell you. But yeah, so ambient commons, I actually am deliberately riffing on Malcolm McCullough's book out in 2013 also called... Ambient Commons. And he was really, he's a wonderful theorist. He's an architectural theorist, but, an accessible one. And he kind of thought through ambient commons in terms of many kind of media architectures of the city, I suppose. And what I loved about him is he said, why are we kind of hyping on these media interfaces? Isn't our whole experience of life kind of in high definition already? So he has this kind of really interesting perception of the integration of digital interfaces and architectural practices. So I highly recommend his, 2013 work. But to me, I wanted to extend that idea or that concept further into our world of ambient computing, because that's a key kind of term in the development of urban technology, whereby, many of the sort of interfaces and indeed kind of AI interfaces are in fact invisible. They're in the ambient kind of background. We're not engaging via our phones or screens. They're much more invisible. And to me, I think I like that term, to draw from in terms of ambient computing is the way that they occupy spaces in the city. They're doing in spaces that, from an urbanistic perspective, from an urbanism perspective, these are our public spaces. And we have a whole kind of series of kind of ethics and values about what the role of these public spaces are in city life, in society and so forth, which is really about ideas of inclusion and connection and these sort of higher order sort of public goods. But at the same time, in that kind of ambient computing landscape, we're not necessarily seeing those values applied, right? Certainly there's a whole services mentality. Let's improve the way people can get around the city. Let's improve identity verification. Let's improve surveillance and security services. Let's improve monitoring of women and women's safety and so forth. There's a whole series of kind of requirements or tasks that are being put to these ambient interfaces. But there's not necessarily an understanding of how much work they're doing in harvesting public data. So to give you an example, out-of-home media is now digital out-of-home media, DOE, as I like to think of in terms of the Simpson analogy. And so this is now an interface. Many of the interfaces of outdoor screens are, hyper-intelligent, and there's this whole lot of, neural networks and tracking and other kinds of monitoring of public spaces, harvesting data from public spaces, which are being used in highly commercial, digital advertising networks. Now, do we want a conversation can we have a conversation about what they're doing with that data, how they're valuing it, how is that data being used for commercial purposes? What is the opportunity that could be missed from actually much more intelligent harvesting of this data for public services or inclusion services? So to me, the term ambient commons is really about this kind of putting an ethics of AI in public spaces at the foreground to say these are kind of common spaces. So how do we want to establish protocols around use for that? And I think it's interesting because, in the absence of these kinds of discussions, we do see blow-ups happen. Take, for example, the new out-of-home infrastructure that was rolled out in the city. There wasn't a discussion around whether or not they should be harvesting data. There wasn't. It was just seen as, well, let's get real-time data, let's get real-time weather updates. And I think that kind of then caused suspicion on behalf of the citizens. Well, hang on, are you tracking me? Hang on, should we have a conversation around this? And I think so it's almost a blooper moment to say, if you don't have conversations, it can lead to conflict and a lot of trouble. And I guess that's why, you know, I've launched a sort of my own initiative, the Storybox Media platform, which is really around saying, well, if we were going to think about public goods and common spaces, what would an alternate kind of approach actually look like? And what does it mean to actually test some of these governance and licensing conversations when you're actually launching products in this space?
So say more, a bit more about Storybox and you know, you're Dr. Sarah Barnes, so I'm thinking you're an academic, but you're also an entrepreneur. So what is it, a bit more about what it is and why were you motivated so much to do it and where are you now at with it?
Yeah, so I've been working on Storybox for last 5 years, actually. It's kind of like, wow, that went fast. And I spent, you know, time out of the university sector actually to do it. When you want to do something like this, you have to sort of throw yourself at it, really. And the intention was to really look at something that was, as I said, that a much more community and public value focused digital infrastructure. So we've launched these 2x2 meter digital cubes, but there is also a whole series of kind of sensors and smaller interventions that sit behind that. But critical to me has also been the kind of partnerships that we enable with local arts and community organizations. We do partnerships with like women's shelters, for example, and other charity organizations. And we launch also with the ABC and a number of other kind of big agencies to sort of say, well, could we actually establish some coalitions across this culture and public media landscape that allows for a different set of conversations around outdoor media and the way that it can occupy public spaces. So that's been you know, it's been successful. We've actually been bootstrapping it for the last few years, but we'll look to see whether we can expand it further.
But just to be clear, you've created a product and a service.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're out there actually, you know, intellectualizing all of it and then promoting this as well, right?
And I should say it's, you know, obviously not just me because I'm not the one that can design the hardware and the software and things like that. I guess I take the leadership approach and the values approach here to enable much cleverer people than me to do the work.
So let's just say there is a kind of dystopian vision and a utopian vision, or, you know, there's a discussion going on about how you use this technology, what it means for public rights, public good, privacy, all that kind of stuff, right? But there is still in me an optimism about some of this, and I'll talk about that now because it fits with the world of urban design and architecture, I think, which is around digital twins and the whole idea. And I mean, I used to roll my eyes, and we'll talk about Andy shortly. I used to roll my eyes when I heard about BIM, you know, the sort of. You know, the world of building and architecture got obsessed about 10 years ago, in my view, and we were at Arup together, and we just used to hear this word all the time, like a BIM, you know, sort of business, building information, what is it?
Modeling.
Yeah, so I was so alienated from it, I couldn't even remember what the acronym said, you know, right? But, as I've matured, and I've sort of realized, oh, that's quite interesting, and I'm quite interested in the interface between data, buildings, you know, business models. So I've matured slightly, but it's, we're going to talk about that. But also digital twin. I think the optimism is something like this, which is that we can give people, you know, that much of the modern world doesn't like development at all. And there's a big NIMBYism thing going on. Part of it is about some of the rubbish we actually build, as I strongly assert. So people are not totally irrational to oppose stuff, you know. But the other side of it is that they can't see what it might be. You know, and they fear the worst. Whereas I think we might be entering an era where you actually can get a really good idea of what it's going to do, how it's going to impact an area. And I think it might be a slightly more empowering moment where the technology and the capacity to create a discussion around what you see will be a very good moment, actually. So better than we've got at the moment. What do you think about that? Am I wrong to be optimistic about that?
No, I mean, look, maybe we're both wrong because I would also be optimistic, and I have always agreed with you, Tim, on that point that we don't have enough kind of conceptual models of what the alternative as a high density or, you know, a high quality density equation looks like. And so I think that incapacity to imagine the alternatives is part of what the problem is. And certainly all the kind of building blocks are now there in terms of, you know, video virtual spaces, and obviously the BIM environment and 3D modeling environment, programs like Unity and so forth, can really create that simulated experience of what the alternative is. I suppose it's the question, you know, it's always the question, look, we have the capability, the technology is there, but what kind of coalitions or what kind of partnerships can be established to actually do the work, and you know, what is the work of actually showing people in, I don't know, around Marrickville or Dulwich Hill or you know, Killara or what have you. I'm talking about suburbs in Sydney that are hot spots for development now. Who's going to invest in those kind of really nuanced local spaces to that extent, like to build the impressive 3D model for that space that shows a development possibility.
It's interesting. I want to talk about this quite a bit actually, and I think and Andy is interested in this discussion. I think it's part of it particularly, but the or all of it. Andy was interested in all of it. I was going to say the digital twin, which literally can replicate in kind of the structure, how it works internally for professional reasons, but you know, how it presents itself on the street and the impact it has. The impact it has is a really important point, because we're all, I think, professionally going forward in the built environment, going to be more and more interested in the impact of our buildings, right? So to be able to, and you know, social impact, environmental performance of buildings, all that stuff will be helped enormously by the technology. There is a kind of positive technological story around that. I wanted to ask you, there's also the capacity to do digital twins of a precinct rather than just, and I hate the word precinct, it's very American, we use it in Sydney, I don't like it, it's a neighborhood, right? So, but we can do a kind of digital twin of a neighborhood. So you can, you know, this all sounds very useful to me, but it does require partnership, working public private things that we're not quite there at yet, it seems to me. But it could help you know, the quality of development as well as the consent to change kind of thing, right?
And I just want to jump in on that point too, Tim, because to me this is also as much an engagement challenge and opportunity. So we see huge amount of investment around the world in digital twins, sometimes called city brains, in places like China. They're very much sort of back-end products, if you like, and certainly becoming more and more intelligent. But in terms of how they actually connect to communities in place, I would like to see much more investment in that space. So how do you actually build the conversations with people in an area? It's not necessarily always online models that can achieve this. And we know the kind of the broken formulas around who shows up to the community engagement workshops, for example. So that's where I do think it's, you know, the technology is there, but let's think about the technology in conversations in communities. How does that work?
More people and more diverse people can help shape the conversation about the city, right? So I do think that's always been a good prospect of this thing, and we might be at an inflection point on it. But definitely where we're at an inflection point is AI. I want to talk about this, a little bit about China, actually. You mentioned it. And then I definitely want Andy's reflections on the conversation. I see him busily making notes, right? But because this drifts into more the kind of interesting architectural and built environment sort of stuff, right? So AI, why is it different? It's smart and AI are sort of different in a way, right? I think of smart as, having read the book, by the way, on artificial intelligence and the city, which is essentially, there's an agency difference, right? So that I think smart was like, in a sense, doing business as usual, but more modernized. And we, the humans, were completely in control of it, as it were, using modern technology. AI, that we forget, artificial, yes, but also autonomous. And that, you know, as your point about the ambient commons is that we're taking, you know, we're automatically taking data, but we're now automatically making decisions. We will increasingly automatically make decisions, just like your house, when it gets a bit hot, it might automatically turn on the air conditioning, as it were, right? So we're beginning to get to decision-making without humans through AI. That is a really big deal. You're also beginning to get, you know, the link of the Chinese thing is interesting, where they're coming together, public, private, around social credit. So your social performance through technology, measured through technology, begins to have an impact on what rights you have. So that's, you know, and we think it's just an authoritarian context. It might not be. It might be that technology is so attractive to do that, we end up with these kinds of things, you know, where we are already finding that people can't get credit. actually, sometimes because of their views are now known. It's all very interesting, right? But let's go back to the city kind of thing, right? Do you think that the AI and the city thing is a big turning point in, and it's a bigger deal than the smart city's sort of origins? Is it a bigger deal?
Yeah, look, I guess I see it as a step change. Certainly, it's all kind of part of the story of the increasing kind of computational intensification of our urban spaces. But AI is really about, I think you understand it well in the way that you've foregrounded the autonomous nature of much AI as it's operating. So I've actually just come from a wonderful few days at NUS where we on urban AI as well. And, you know, one of my colleagues in this space, Federico Cugurullo, he likes to talk about the fact that we have many more sort of more than human agents or non-human agents that are kind of taking up certain rights, if you like, in the city, in the same way that we would expect our own rights to operate. So thinking about that idea of autonomous agents is really critical here. And I think you know, the landscape, our cities are already diffused with AI. You know, we talk about, you know, we've got many fundamental autonomous decision makers already operating at many scales. But I think that the step change is really in the extent to which they are allowed to proliferate and the way that they're allowed to, the way that they will accelerate. Because once you're actually operating in an environment, your capacity to harvest data is hugely accelerated. So that's why, you know, the Teslas, for example, they need to be on the road in the testing environments. This is, you know, the years past, because that's where they'll get the volume of data. You can do simulated work, you know, in a lab, but it's actually in the urban space that you'll get the maximum data accumulation. And if I can just jump in on that point, you know, I think sometimes AI gets associated with certain parts of our landscape, like, for example, the focus on ChatGPT and conversational AI. But, you know, AI in BIM, you know, AI in construction innovation, AI in transport, AI in the city brain, these are all, you know, it's almost a too big a term, but we like to use it, right? I mean, I talk about AI as basically the process of turning unstructured data into structured data.
But it generates structures itself sometimes. Is the point.
And that's what I wanted to say, that I think in a sense the need to coordinate across those different domains of activity in the urban space, I think architects have a good role to play in playing that role of coordination of data flows and data management throughout from a design to construction to implementation and to evaluation.
Well, that evaluation point at the end, I want to end with, and then I will definitely go to Andy, who is very patient, is the capacity now exists to do something I now realize that architects haven't really been able to do because of the contractual nature of designing and building a building, which is that the performance data from the operation of what you've just designed it doesn't automatically go back to an architect. And I just think that's like, wow, how do I learn to do the next building? But I think we're at a point again where I like this discussion, the idea that the technology will actually drive collaborations and new business models where it kind of makes sense for I'm speculating, but it makes sense for the developer and the asset owner to have a relationship over time in subsequent buildings with an architect, because we want to share the data and learn together from it, right? So I think there's something interesting coming as a result of this, you know, that we can now understand the performance of a building far more and its impact far more. We should be feeding back much more, I think, into the process of design and building. We'll see what happens.
You are listening to the Grimshaw Podcast, the Intelligent City Series, with your host, Tim Williams.
Andy, your reflections on any of this? We ended with a bit on architecture. What is a design technology and what is your role?
Well, first of all, Tim, thank you very much for having me on. And I think you undersell yourself a little bit when it comes to technology. The fact that you appreciate its potential, I think, is the major driving factor behind it. You don't necessarily have to know how to do it, but the appreciation of it is a big thing. What is design technology? So at Grimshaw, we have a design technology team which covers BIM, you know, your favorite acronym, computational design, so how we can use computation for automation and analysis and things like that. And then moving into more emerging technologies like extended reality, so things like VR and AR and things like that. and also urban scale computation, how we can be looking at, you know, large scale open source or private data sets and how they can impact, how we can learn from and feed into those as well.
And in terms of the link with architecture, as it were, and you're an architect, aren't you, as well as a, so say a bit about that then, because it's a unique thing. It's not just like data and stuff. It's specifically targeted at an architectural practice, right?
I mean, it is. It's built around the technologies that we as architects use, and really with the mind of how we can improve the way that we produce architecture. You know, that's, I'd say, the fundamental tenet of our team in particular, is how we can enable our architects to realize their designs to the best of their ability.
Can I kill one thing? Because I've been spreading a rumor that I think you disagree with me, which is I've been worrying that the ChatGPT version and the generative AI stuff could mean IP problems with the technology ransacking libraries of the universe and coming up with stuff that you don't know the provenance of, and it might be somebody else's work. But also that whole thing of generating options definitely will do that, whether or not there's IP problems. We'll talk about that later. But carry on. What's your observation on the discussion? What interests you most?
Well, there's a lot of interesting things that have kind of come through in the conversation. I think there's a general underlying theme of digital transformation. And, you know, you talked about smart cities and how that came about almost in a hobbyist kind of way. And then there's the discussion about how you can get engagement and partnership from others. And that's a fundamental tenet of digital transformation. It's not just about the technology, it's about actually changing the culture which is required to embrace that technology. And I think with smart cities, when you were talking about that at the beginning, there was very much this feeling that smart cities is a hobby, maybe by one or two departments, but government en masse won't embrace it because not everybody is necessarily bought into it. Similarly, I think when we talk about you know, that whole organic versus planned smart city. So organic in terms of things like Uber and that digitization of that aspect of our cities. I think it comes back to that buy-in, that culture, because there's a buy-in because people want that. People know what it means and they're going to think, okay, Uber's brilliant. I'm going to order myself a taxi and away I go. A smart city, you know, the people on the pavement aren't necessarily going to think, you know what, I want to live in a smart city. Because what is the benefit for them? And so there really needs to be that communication back to, you know, the residents, the community, about actually what that means and how that could help them.
It's interesting, though, you picked on a very good example of where it comes back to, when I first met Sarah, you know, I was proud of myself and my own conceptualization, which nobody picked up, which is essentially smart city, smart governance first, you know, and how this can help it, right? And I think that the Uber thing is a good example, actually, right? Where, in an unplanned way, completely because somebody came up with a brilliant idea, and it so quickly got out there that the public sector couldn't even think through what the consequences would be. It's rather like what happened with Airbnb, you know, where the Airbnb has actually probably raised prices of homes and taken a lot of rental off the market. Nobody thought that, not even the Airbnb people thought that was going to happen, right? The Uber thing is interesting because it's led to congestion, greater congestion in our cities, and an undermining of mass transit, right? Because people use these other options. Now, I'm not saying go back. I'm just saying that the technology in itself did things that even the technologists didn't expect it to do to the city. So it's it really is an interesting example of how you try and manage the policy implications of something in the round with this like narrow technological triumph that actually destabilizes things around it. I never thought of it in that way before. But look, in terms of the discussion and the built environment and all this kind of thing, do you think that we are at a point where, you know, Grimshaw's one, but architects generally are like enthusiastically going into this universe, or is it still quite hobbyist, if you like, within architecture?
I don't think it's necessarily a hobbyist. I think it's becoming an imperative. Right. I think but it comes back to the idea of changing culture. I think Sarah put it very well that the technology is there, but not necessarily the participation or the engagement with it. We're starting to see that change because it is becoming an imperative. It is also feeding into competition because, you know, within architecture, we are in competition with other architects. And different practices are going to be moving at different paces. So, you know, for us to stay ahead or stay towards the front of the pack, we're going to need to embrace these technologies as we move forward. I think also you touched on you know, a very interesting point at the end, just before I came in, which is around digital twins and yeah. feedback and things like that. Because data is becoming such a, frankly, a currency now within how we're operating, that things like digital twins and that ability to understand how a building is performing, and the ability to then actually use that to feed back into the next design, I think is incredibly powerful. And it's something that contractually, as you say, we haven't been able to do. But, you know, me from a very digital perspective, you know, I've seen there's been a lot of conversation in the industry around circular economy when it comes to actually the physical building material and how that can then, you know, feed back. But we're not thinking about the circularity of data, the fact that we design, that's then turned into construction information, that's then turned into operational information as a building is being used. And then there's a dead end because there isn't that closed loop of actually then feeding back into the next design, whether that's of a typology, of a portfolio, or anything like that. And I think that could be incredibly powerful for us if there is, as you say, the contractual apparatus in place for it.
This is quite important. It's an interesting, people might think it's a detail, it's actually a big thing about how buildings get done and how you become a learning organization to do better next time. And we haven't been able to do that as a kind of built environment culture because of the contractual elements. And I think that the technology is necessarily driving this conversation. And it might lead to builders that are technologists and technologists that are builders. You know, it might lead to business process dissolution, melting and recombination. You know, I think that this, that bigger potential, just like we saw some of the technology companies try and become developers. And, you know, that's an interesting aside, by the way. Let's just go there for a moment, right? So Toronto, right? My perception of that is that they raced ahead with sort of great thinking and stuff. And actually, some of the reasons they fell down were actually development reasons rather than technology reasons, i.e., and also that they didn't really understand the planning system, I think, is essentially but there were special reasons why it failed. But that was an example of big thinking and a convergence of business models, you know. So reflections on that. And I also want to talk about, before we disappear, I want to talk about China again, because the reason I want to raise it is because the two things come together there. The smart city thing kind of carried on and had some real focus in some cities, you know, as a national priority in China. But also the development of urbanism carried on, you know, whereas we've paused a bit since COVID, and, you know, we haven't got so much confidence in that kind of city form, as it were, that we used to have. And we've seen decentralized knowledge working, for God's sake, you know, in hybrid working. China's 100% back in the office. You know, Seoul is 100%. There seems to be an Asian cities difference going on. And I have this idea that they might be developing smart city stuff, AI stuff, and urbanism, whereas we've paused. Anyway, what do you think? That's a positive story about China you never hear, you know, right?
Toronto's a really interesting case to me. Quayside is a waterfront precinct that was essentially identified by Sidewalk Labs, which is a Google sister company, so parent company being Alphabet. And they identified this as with the Toronto Waterfront Authority, I think that's the agency, identified a partnership to co-develop this waterfront precinct. And the idea was to establish a new precinct built from the internet up, to quote the language. So that everything could be built with sustainability, circularity in mind, but also to use data to its greatest potential to achieve those goals. It is now considered, you know, a huge. The project was so controversial that it did not go ahead. I think it was cancelled in 2020, I believe, maybe slightly earlier than that, due to basically lack of what's considered kind of social license to operate. So it was too controversial to go ahead. But the case is really interesting to me because. A few different reasons. There was an urban data trust that was established as a means to progress the ideas, the planning proposals. Because ultimately, look, having a Google sister company involved in building a city, I mean, that's a huge kind of step change in an environment where you've got growing, you know, tech lash, against.
Is that what they're calling it?
the tech clash is a kind of, yeah, that's the sort of 2018 onwards is how we kind of went, hang on a second, what are you guys doing?
Intellectually and culturally, I'm only up to 2017, so that was pretty useful.
So they were doing this at the, you know, at the pinnacle of this tech clash that was going on. So I think that's a fundamental problem that they had. Many of the really active citizens and campaigners against the program were, you know, concerned about key tenets of that project, which ultimately I felt were not that dissimilar to most infrastructure and development projects, but just because it had having that Google association, I think was particularly problematic.
Two cultures we don't generally like, you know, the tech companies and developers.
Exactly.
You know, they're not popular out there. So no. Two together coming together
Equivalently Google.
Even if I love developers, obviously.
There was a lack of transparency around how data would be shared, you know, across the agencies, you know, with Google. And that's why the data trust was set up. And I would actually, I think in my chapter, I do go in. There's a wonderful colleague in Canada who's done a really good detailed analysis of the Urban Data Trust and what the ideas were behind that. So that's in the Ambient Commons article. But I think what's interesting is that meanwhile, across the world, there are many of these precincts being developed. They're kind of considered kind of AI cities, whereby there is special kind of provisions or licenses in place for not just development, but also tech companies to come and play. They are residential in nature. And the idea is that you can, to live there, you're already signing away your data rights. You know that your data is going to be collected for the purposes of building new products and services by these companies. I think there's obviously going to be, benefits to living in these, whether it's because of their quality of life, the quality of services and so forth. But this is a space that I'm really interested in at the moment, because these are proceeding, across China, the well-known one is the Line, NEOM's project. Lucknow in India has now been announced as, you know, a huge new AI city for India. And so there are these really interesting development models that are emerging through those partnerships, which I would say are much more possible in environments where there isn't the same kind of expectation around data privacy.
No, it's true.
That we have in Western culture.
To close off that part of the conversation, I want to ask Andy something about where he thinks the profession's going next in terms of architecture and technology. But that closing off that part of the conversation, I think the easy thing to say about all that stuff is that it's in an authoritarian context, and people then stop the conversation, I think. Whereas actually, your point that you're alluding to, there's lots of interesting things in all that, that if we don't find the capacity to replicate them perhaps in a more open way, I think we go backwards a bit. I think there is actually a way of marrying, I think, some of the virtues of that development model and learning from it and all that with a kind of a more democratic approach. But I don't sneer at that stuff. I think there's quite a lot of interesting stuff going on over there. Now, Andy, where do you think, you know, what you've been trying to do within a company, but the profession as such and technology, what are the things that are coming up that you think that's the direction we're going in, these are the tools we're going to use, what kind of stuff is that we can tell people to think about?
I think there's a few different ways of thinking actually about, take AI in architecture as a start. There's a few different ways of thinking. So it's obviously at the forefront of our minds at the moment. Within Grimshaw, we've got an AI working group, and that's starting to look at, you know, how artificial intelligence can help us with design, how it can help us with how we operate, and marrying those two together. But there's also an interesting question, and I think, Sarah, you've alluded to it in a few different ways, which is then how can we actually design architecture with AI in mind? Not necessarily using AI, but architecture for AI. So take something, a very small example might be the Amazon shops that were out there where you know, using AI, you walk in, you don't speak to anyone, you pick up your items, you walk out, and your Amazon account will be charged, which, you know, was interesting, but it actually changed how that space is then perceived, because you don't need checkouts or anything like that. But then think about how AI technologies may affect things like the check-in process at an airport, or the use of rail stations or stadia or anything like that. And actually, you know, the rules of thumb that we've had for years about how these spaces operate and how they need to be set out is going to change. So actually the typologies that we focus on are going to be changed by AI, and we're going to need to be able to design with that in mind.
I think that's crucial. I think that's a really brilliant point. It came to me when we've been looking at a lot of logistics propositions, you know. And although part of me is you know is slightly upset at the idea that these are kind of could be labor free, you know, sort of human free activities, the reality is that they're coming at us. And thinking through what a warehouse of the future looks like and is how you design it. So as you say, it's a good phrase, I think, you know, designing for AI, not just using AI, is a really important concept, you know, because otherwise, I think it means the coming together of this kind of technology with architecture. It's not like these are separate, this is just a tool. This is a universe we're entering. And you need to think through that, I think. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's right. I mean, if you want to take a slightly dystopian slant on it, we've got another resident, which is AI, and we're going to have to design with them in mind. It's just kind of there in the background. But no, I think there is a huge amount to change there. And actually, I would say that's probably the more imminent focus for architecture, because the limits of AI at the moment and the models that are out there, the way they're working, is two-dimensional. AI cannot yet properly do the third dimension, which isn't going to fundamentally change the way that we as architects work or design or produce buildings. And so I think the much more immediate impact is actually going to be on the typologies that we work with.
It's very interesting, designing for autonomous buildings, as it were, which is, I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a very good perception, if I might say so. Very good. So on that point, I think we're going to bring this really good conversation to an end, sadly. We'll probably have another one, I think, about it, because it's like, as I say, it's a universe, not a chapter. It's a whole library that we're entering. To conclude our affable and informed conversation, Sarah, any further reflections? Where next? What's going on? What are the things that sort of fill your mind about this?
I'm really interested in the ways in which we are seeing major urban transformation projects in precincts. You see, you don't like that word, but that's what we see it used a lot, like the way that's a kind of step change in some of the autonomous kind of technologies being developed. I'm really fascinated in, I guess, this kind of idea of like war of ecosystems. So we've actually got a lot of much more sort of state-backed or sovereign-backed ecosystems that are developing. So based off the China model versus based off the US model. And then we've got the EU model. We've got the EU AI Act, which is, you know, establishing different protocols. So I guess in the next, say, decade, I can anticipate that we'll have some tangibly distinct experiences being developed in these different geopolitical regions. I think that'll be fascinating to see emerge and what it all means.
So I agree, and it allows me a pompous ending where I put my own views in about this. I like the idea that there are state models. AI doesn't evolve in a vacuum. It evolves in a kind of state, right? And thus far, the slightly authoritarian notion of a state has probably progressed quite far in a top-down way, but I think we can learn from that. Then you've got the kind of free market sort of notion in which, you know, AI is as a private sector kind of thing, really, and the public sector sort of buys it, you know. And I think that's not quite right or robust enough either. I think the middle road is probably where, you know, Western society should go. And the only thing I was going to say that really is pompous and shows that I do really have a perspective on these things is the problem with the EU model is that it's not quite what Mariana Mazzucato would think of as a mission-led approach. It's become it's a regulatory state. It's the use of the state as regulator rather than the use of the state as investor. And I think that this so-called authoritarian state still have the better of us in terms of investment in this going forward. But look, on that amazingly good conversation, thank you both, Andy, and Dr. Barnes.
Great pleasure, Tim. I hope to speak again sometime.
Thank you very much, Tim.
You have been listening to the fourth series of the Grimshaw podcast, The Intelligent City, with your host, Tim Williams. Join us again for other episodes in this series from your favorite podcast provider.